The Tom Woods Show, episode 1411.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, this episode is brought to you by Policy Genius. No matter how much or how little you know about life insurance, you can find the right policy in minutes at policygenius.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. It's day two of Michael Malice Week on The Tom Woods Show. We're discussing his brand new book, The New Right, A Journey to the Fringe of American Politics. I thought today we would talk about humor and whether there are limits to humor. Are there some areas that are off limits to humor? The use of humor by the new right and memes and all this sort of stuff. And of course, Michael, as well, a humorist in his own right and a troll of sorts, surely has some thoughts to share with us on that. And it's an interesting topic, I think, to dig into. And it does touch on the subject matter of his book. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. It's been a while.
Yeah, seems like only yesterday. And actually, it was only 5 minutes ago. All right. We're talking about humor today. We're going to talk about humor with the new right as the backdrop, but also just humor as a phenomenon and whether there are limits to it or whether there are some things that are off limits, stuff like that. But I want to start off by reading what one of the things I loved in this book, this quotation from Joan Rivers, because of course, Joan Rivers was notorious even when I was a kid in the 80s for the kinds of jokes she would tell about celebrities. It was amazing. So CNN, apparently in 2014, interviewed her, and they talked to her about making jokes on subjects that, quote, seem off limits to a lot of people. And so Joan Rivers came back with, "Life is very tough, and if you can make something easier and funny, do it. Winston Churchill said, if you make someone laugh, you give them a vacation. And maybe you take the worst thing in the world, make it funny, and give them a vacation from horror." And I thought, wow, that is great. And then you write that she then walked off the set, herself offended at the interviewer. Wow. I love that. So talking about this, you're somebody who you've been a troll. You enjoy it. We enjoy watching it. A little bit later in this episode, we'll talk about your notorious Elizabeth Warren tweet that got the attention of Don Jr. So that has to come up. But let's get, again, a little bit more, you know, from 35,000 feet kind of overview. Do you have an approach, like a, not a philosophy of humor, but how do you think about it? And are there things that you would say are just too serious to be subject to humor or what? What's your approach to that?
I can't think of, well, the metaphor I use is this. If you ask someone if flour, F-L-O-U-R, is food, they don't really know how to answer it, right? Because everyone has eaten flour in bread, but you don't eat flour directly. So to say that, you know, abortion isn't grounds for humor, well, just saying the word abortion is not grounds for humor. And this is an extremely serious issue, regardless of where you stand on it. And, you know, this is something that people take very seriously and correctly take very seriously. But the point is, the more complicated the ingredient, the more skill it takes to make it palatable. So there are certain subjects that have an emotional response that, yeah, people would personally not find it funny. But at the same time, to say that if it's off limits to me, and here's a very easy example. Let's suppose someone had been assaulted and you're making jokes about that. It's going to kind of trigger that memory and they're not comfortable with it. That's very legitimate. And if they said, hey, don't make those jokes around me, they don't owe you an explanation. That's very legitimate. But progressivism teaches that what is appropriate for one person has to be appropriate for everybody. It's this universalist idea. And this is something I reject completely. So just because something is not appropriate for someone doesn't mean it's not appropriate for everyone. And I go through examples of, you know, very dark jokes about, you know, subjects that are considered off limits. And off the top of my head, one I can give is, you know, Bonnie McFarlane, who's a great comedian. She was roasting Jim Norton. And she said to him, "Jimmy, your radio show is so unlistenable. I would rather hear my daughter drowning." Now, you may not like the joke, whatever. Are you going to tell her as a mom and as a professional comic that she's not in a position to tell it? That does not ring true with me.
I love this this paragraph about one of your friends. You say, laughter can obviously be a bonding experience. In 2017, I attended an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting where my friend was commemorating her 10-year anniversary of being sober. One by one, the addicts who were also celebrating that day got up and told stories of the travails they had suffered. 8 years ago, I was in a mental institution, one man recalled. I was homeless. I was in the hospital. I was in jail. I was in the shelter. I did the whole tour. The room burst into laughter. It'd be safe to say none of those four experiences is a laughing matter. Yet in this case, each one quite literally was, especially given the man's grateful caveat that the one stop on the tour he managed to avoid was death.
Yeah, Tom, I was very proud of you for getting up in front of the room and saying all those things. You really touched a lot of people.
And I'm glad you properly gendered me in that reference there to she. You know, I've been
I meant the man speaking.
Oh, that man, right. Not your original friend.
I'm not in AA, so the anonymous doesn't have to play.
Yeah, I was very proud of myself having the guts to say that. So I love that. And I love, so in a way, it kind of reminds us that even if you're inclined to think some things aren't joking matters, even there can be contexts in which they are. Now, see, the thing is, I myself, not that anybody cares about my own approach to this, but I've increasingly become much less of a fuddy-duddy about stuff like this. But there are still things, like, for example, a lot of people absolutely rave about a Broadway show called The Book of Mormon.
Okay.
But yet I know for a fact they are laughing at making fun of Mormons in that show. And I feel like just because I know so many good people, I don't agree with them theologically, but I know so many good Mormons, I just wouldn't have fun sitting in a show where they're being made fun of. So
that's
I wouldn't
very
go.
Fair. I think that's very fair. And you're, but at the same time, you're not at all even thinking for a second that this show should be shut down or it shouldn't exist or that the music can't possibly be good. You know, no one's making this, you're not making this claim remotely. So, and I do think a lot of times humor is used completely, what you're saying, to as a mechanism to be, dominate and to dismiss and to take away the reverence for things that should be revered. So I do talk about how the left does use humor as a weapon in their own way. And it's been going on. Jon Stewart is the best example of this, where instead of, you know, this the old adage about a comedian is it's funny because it's true. With these types, it's true because it's funny. So they make you laugh and then they sneak in their kind of progressive ideology. But this has been going on, as I demonstrate in the book, since at least the 1920s with the Algonquin Roundtable, which met in New York. So conservatives, you know, I criticize them a lot. And one of the things that this book fills a hole in is conservatives have this idea that things are bad now, but at some golden age in the past, they were good. And I you know, you ask them, when did these things turn? And they want to say, like, you know, after the 50s, but it's kind of like, again, before that, you had the red decade, the 30s, where the communists were like the hip intellectual vanguard in this country. So their view of how history works is often, I'm going to say it, lazy, because they just draw a line directly, you know, and they just extend the line backwards into the past, and ahistorical, which is more important.
Let's talk about how the new right has used humor and memes, things of this sort, in ways that have, well, gotten them attention, but also, you know, really riled up a lot of people.
Yeah, Carpe Donctum, who's President Trump's favorite meme maker, just took a video, you know, this isn't in the book, but this happened recently, this took the State of the Union, and all, you know, Trump's kind of rousing speech, and he had these shots of all the Democrats in the audience with their sourpusses, you know, rolling their eyes, whatever, and he said it to the music video Everybody Hurts by R.E.M., and it was hilarious. And Twitter pulled it. They said it was because of copyright, whatever, fine. He made the video for my book, which, you know, you could see that on my Twitter, which is pretty funny. But humor, Rothbard, I give Rothbard credit for this. This is Rothbard's influence, or at least, you know, the Rothbardianism on the new right. This idea of the people who are in charge are not only bad, they're also buffoons. And they trick you into thinking they're dignified because they're in suits and they have tradition and they have prestige. But the more you can make them look to be the silly jerks that they are, that's a very effective political mechanism to delegitimizing the state and state action. And I could not agree with him more. And I'll give you an example. I was on a talk show a couple of years back, and I was talking about Henry Waxman, who was a former Democratic congressman from California. And I'm no looker, But if you guys, you know, look up Henry Waxman online, the man looks like he's from the island of Dr. Moreau. And I said that. I said, you know, the fact that he looks like a cross between a human and a bat is great for the environment because it shows that, you know, different species can coexist within one being. And everyone was laughing very hard. And during the commercial, the other panelist I was on with, who was a conservative, turns to me, and Waxman was a strident leftist. You know, he wasn't some, you know, middle of the road nobody. He was like an Eric Swalwell of his day. She turns to me and she goes, you know, he's still an elected official. You shouldn't talk about him that way.
Oh, typical conservative.
Oh. I don't think that's typical. I don't think most of them would actually pull me aside during the commercial. They might roll their eyes or not be comfortable with it, but to actually kind of chide me. And I looked at her and I'm like, you are, I didn't even know what to say. I was just like, you're so many orders removed from my thought process that I don't even know where to begin.
Yeah, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, I guess what I'm driving
at
is—
One more thing, Tom. Yeah, I bet you Henry Waxman would roll his eyes if push came to shove.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking about those people who they'll say, well, we still need to respect the office kind of thing. That's just, I'm so sick. Oh, stop talking to me. You got to stop talking.
Triggered.
Now, you had— Now, this obviously also isn't in the book because it was after you wrote it. But you, for a weekend, were bombarded with Twitter notifications because of one particular tweet of yours. And it's the type of tweet that some people would say is just not acceptable. And others got a real kick out of it. Can you share it?
I sure. This happened not that long, a while back. But basically, President Trump, you know, made a dig at Elizabeth Warren. And in all caps wrote the word trail, which was taken, I think, correctly as a reference to the Trail of Tears.
And yeah, but he was saying the campaign trail. So that was the context. But right, with trail in all caps, right.
It was clearly a play on words. I mean, I don't— – there's no other—
– Well, just so people were knowing why he used the word trail, used it in that phrase.
No. He used it as a reference to trail. I mean—
– I get it. But I mean, like, trail is a very unusual word. My point is how the way it came up in his tweet was he said, see you on the campaign trail. And then you then—
– No. He capitalized trail. So it wasn't just like he was using this word randomly. He was using it knowingly because why else is he capitalizing an entire— – not the T. He capitalized every letter. Why would he do that if he was just referring to only to the campaign trail?
I know. It's not only to the campaign trail. My right. point
There's
is that was how he said it. Right.
Right. It's a plain words.
So and now what you did is unbelievable.
And I don't remember the exact wording. It was something like yet another murder. President Trump adds to the Native American genocide or something like that, or another scalp claimed. And Eric Trump, you know, took a screen cap, put it on Instagram, and people were coming at me for days. And it was hilarious. And he followed me as a consequence of that. But yeah,
it was the exact words were you wrote, the Native American genocide continues with another murder by the president.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Just like that.
So, right. So the thing is, she's not Native American, nor was she murdered. And I wrote an article for The Federalist breaking down my thought process and how I even came to this, you know, that kind of syntax, which is not uncommon on the internet. I got the idea, as I do many of my stupid ideas, from a Reddit thread on RuPaul's Drag Race, where one person was— – there was a lip sync and someone commented, hello, 911, I'd like to report a murder. You know, so it was the same kind of line and it became a whole huge thing. But yeah, and I think, you know, this is a little bit of a tangent. I think President Trump has broken that woman. And she is a shambles of what she was because she was from Harvard, professor, in her private life, very well respected. She's, you know, wasn't particularly, but I would consider her a wonk who was nerdy and informed about technical things. And now she became the best part of that. He spends a year, take a DNA test, take a DNA test, take a DNA test. She takes it. And then he goes, who cares? And what do you do with that? So to go from where you want to be, her talking about ideas and banking and interest rates and so on and so forth, and now you're spitting in a cup at the behest of this guy who you think is a buffoon, that is really denigrating and hilarious.
Now, it's been
a
while.
Never recovered.
Right. I don't remember exactly when I saw it, so it may have changed a little. But the one poll I did see in Massachusetts, her home state, had her in third in her own home state, and that was before Biden jumped in.
Oh yeah, yeah. She's a waste. She's a big fat mistake.
Now, can we? This is, you have a chapter where you're talking about memes and humor.
Yeah.
The Kathy Griffin discussion is not in that chapter, but I think it's still relevant to a discussion of humor, of course, because she's supposed to be a humorist, and we all know about the episode where she's got Trump's severed head, and as you say, she probably just thought, well, sometimes humor is about one-upping the previous person.
Yes.
So now I'm going to do this. What in the world do you think happened there? Where all of a sudden this one thing became absolutely off limits. It's hard to understand in a way.
Yeah. The point I made at the time is if she had done that same photo and while wearing a hijab, I think she would have gotten away with it. Right. Because then it's really, they would have been free speech and she's, you know, making fun of Islam, blah, blah, blah. There was an organized movement from the new right to take her down. And everyone I talked to said, oh, I don't care about the stupid picture. Because it was a stupid picture. I mean, the idea that she's threatening to kill him, I don't think anyone took it seriously. Now, some people with family in the military were genuinely offended because, like, you know, my son served with someone who was beheaded or, you know, who was overseas. And for you to kind of think this is silly is completely inappropriate. And I understand that. But by and large, the activists who, you know, I spoke with, they were like, no, 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 we're going to ruin her life and traumatize her and make an example of her. And that's what she did. For the rest of her life, there will always be those clips of her being on TV, literally crying, saying, he broke me, he broke me. And she was clearly and understandably traumatized by what had happened to her. She didn't understand where this came from. And this also speaks to the kind of echo chamber effect where if you do talk to, we talked about yesterday's episode, how if they want to have this whole population be driven underground and pretend they don't exist, well, all of a sudden they're going to pop up and ruin your life and you're not going to see it coming.
In your chapter on this, you tell the story of what happened with a fellow named Ben Garrison. Can you tell us that story a bit?
Oh gosh, Ben Garrison. So Ben Garrison is this like boomer, you know, political cartoonist out of Montana. I think he lives on a ranch. Just, you know, he was drawing all these cartoons about like Ben Bernanke and Obama, you know, like it was good stuff, but it's hardly disturbing. So what people did on the internet to this poor guy, and the thing is they picked him at random. So you can imagine him being like, why me? Like, what if, it's like Job. They took all of his artwork and replaced it with racist and anti-Semitic imagery. So instead of it being Bernanke, it's a Jewish caricature from the 40s, you know, and everything's about Israel. And they made him out to be a literal Nazi. They updated his Wikipedia. They invented a whole backstory. They had all these nicknames for him. So if you start Googling him, you know, Ben Garrison, and the thing is the artwork was Photoshopped so well, you couldn't see which was the original. And, you know, eventually they kind of backed away. And, you know, now he's known as this kind of pro-Trump political cartoonist. But for a while there, I mean, the guy must have felt like Kafka.
Yeah, that is such a bizarre thing to have happen. I mean, we've seen at least some people that I think they've backed off of this. But for a long time, people were doing memes of Taylor Swift making white nationalist remarks.
Oh, yeah, she had Hitler quotes, right?
Yeah.
Overlaid on her. And there was also, before that, Honey Boo Boo, they had gifs of her, and that is how it's pronounced, with Nietzsche quotes.
Yeah, now that's and the thing is, as you know, there are many people who will look at that and think it's authentic when it's obviously not meant to. You're supposed to figure out that that's not real.
But,
and there are plenty of people who will walk away thinking it was real.
But the other thing about the new right and humor is that for a long time, one of the big cudgels used against Republicans and conservatives specifically was that these people are squares, that it's all Mitt Romney types. There are, you know, instead of getting drunk and having fun at college, they're, you know, playing Parcheesi and they're all repressed and boring and uptight, right? And there might have been some truth to that. Who knows? Now, I mean, these people are having fun. They are having a good time. And that is very attractive to young people. And that is a big distinction between the new right and traditional conservatism.
Yeah. And in fact, at the very end of your book, you come back to that point and say that this new right gives young people an opportunity to be edgy and not just say, well, I've got here a copy of the new study of agriculture policy, and here's what...
And you know, that here's the other thing. It's funny because different contexts, the kind of thing that's edgy on The Big Bang Theory, as opposed to the kind of thing that's edgy, you know, when you're getting drunk with your friends at a bar, these are very different contexts. So in terms of the things you see on the internet, which is where, you know, Goatsy lives, and don't look that up, people, if you don't know who that is, you can't get, edginess is just off the charts. There's things that even I can't wrap my head around. So in terms of the internet, the book is not edgy per se. In terms of mainstream publishing, Tom, would you not agree that this is a shockingly edgy book?
Yes, yes, it absolutely is. In fact, the thing I wrote to you, one of the first things I said in the email to you was, this is a brave book. And I said, it's braver than any of my books.
Yeah, so that's, I really wanted it to be provocative for people in bookstores. And I also forget that, you know, because I swim in these circles and I am a bit of a hipster, or a lot of a hipster rather, things that are kind of mainstream and eye-rolly to me, when I talk about to people who actually are mainstream, they have no idea what I'm talking about. And they're very, like, I'll give you an example. This wasn't in the book. There's this, and I think a certain subset of your audience is going to laugh, like 10%. The other ones are going to find it funny too, but they're not going to know the reference. There's a group called the Insane Clown Posse, right? There are these two guys out of Detroit. They dress in clown makeup and they have a movement called Juggalos. I can't believe I'm talking about this on Tumblr show. And they sing songs about like murdering people, all right? So they have a song called Stabbin', and they have a song called Still Stabbin'. And Still Stabbin' starts with, I still have this stabbing problem. And he talks about him going around stabbing people. And I had a job interview, this must have been 20 years ago, 15 years ago. And I was talking about the song, you know, he talks about how he took his producer and threw him out of the window and he chopped up the mailman. And I was telling him, and the guy's like, yeah, man, there's some really disturbing people out there. And I'm like, oh, you don't have the framework to understand this. To you, this is like people singing about murder, whereas to me, it's like they call themselves clowns. They're dressed like clowns. I mean, there's no pretense that this is, he's actually killing people. So it was just very interesting to see just how reserved most mainstream thought is. So for people like that, they are going to, you know, have their socks knocked off.
Folks, I would not dream of interrupting a conversation with Michael Malice if it were not for your own good, and particularly for the good of your family. Your family needs protection if something happens to you, so you have to have life insurance. But don't worry, getting it is a simple process because old Woods here has you set up with Policy Genius. Policy Genius is the easy way to buy life insurance online. Just 2 minutes, you can be comparing quotes from top insurers to find your best price. And once you apply, the Policy Genius team handles all the paperwork and red tape. And there's no commissions, no hidden fees, just financial protection and peace of mind, no strings attached. And I can attest from my own experience just how easy PolicyGenius.com is to use. And it's not just life insurance that Policy Genius simplifies. They also make it easy to compare and buy home insurance, auto insurance, and disability insurance. Getting life insurance is one of the important transitions to adulthood. So if you have not done it, now is the time, and PolicyGenius.com is going to make it easy for you. Policy Genius, the easy way to buy life insurance online. You mentioned Rothbard earlier on, but there's a quotation from Hans Hoppe, which I cannot find right now, in which he says that, you know, one of the steps, he lays out a series of steps that need to be taken for us to move to a better society, a stateless society. And he says one of them is that politicians, instead of being revered, need to be ridiculed and laughed at.
Yeah.
And so that's also a big part of this. So what's the significance of this? So why would we do an episode on this? What should people conclude from what we're talking about here? Why does it matter? Why is it important to your story?
Well, I mean, I don't know why we're doing an episode on it. It's your show. Why I think it's important is if something, it's like trying to lose weight. If it's going to be a function of willpower every day, and there's no diet that you can stick to long term. If it's something that doesn't take willpower, you'll be able to sustain it for years. And that is an effective mechanism to lose weight, right? So if you're going to have a political or social movement where it's not fun and it's not enjoyable, you're doomed to defeat. People have to get something out of it. So the more fun it is, the more attractive it is to people who are even not even ideological. They just want to have a good time. And this is very much the lure that the left uses for young people. We've got all the fun people. Come join us. And then it becomes, you know, then you're done. So I think the fact that, and we're seeing it right now with the reaction hardcore from Twitter and Facebook on trying to censor memes and satirical sites, because it is such an effective mechanism at showing who the real fuddy-duddies are.
All right. Well, that then leads to the question about the relationship between the left and humor, because it's very easy to say that people on the left are humorless, and particularly in the face of some of these provocative attacks from the other side. But on the other hand, I am quite sure, at least with traditional conservatives, if not with the new right, there are some areas where if humor were inserted, they would be up in arms and humorless. So is it just, well, they do it and we do it? Or is there a qualitative difference here? Is the left fundamentally on major things, things pertaining to what you call the cathedral, things that are close to the heart of their ideology? Is there a real difference in how they think about humor?
Well, first of all, that's a couple questions. First of all, I wouldn't say necessarily that conservatives are humorless, more that humorless people tend to become conservatives. That's how I think the process works. With regards to the left, you know, they're, in my view, a direct line from the certain type of leftist of today through Carrie Nation with her axe, chopping up the saloon and trying to end sales of alcohol. And H.L. Mencken has that great quote that Puritanism is the sneaking fear that someone somewhere might be happy. So that element of WASPy Puritanism, this has been a straight line. If you look at Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt is a leftist and a progressive. He's telling jokes. Wilson is not. So the left will have both aspects. There will be the John Stewarts, you know, and so on and so forth. But many of them really do have this, I will use this word very intentionally, Stalinist approach to society. And because it is a fundamentalist faith, there could be no room for anything unserious anywhere, because this is something that they take very, very serious indeed. And their faith and their worldview has to insert itself and insinuate itself into every single aspect of human existence.
Well, let me add, with regard to the subject of humor, that there's plenty of humor in the book, first of all, in the way you tell the story. And occasionally you'll have some asides, or you'll say, like, I don't want to give it away, but you have a remark about Vince Foster that is just... it's just like an afterthought, but it's so beautiful. It's so perfect. But that's sprinkled throughout the book. So it's like I'm being guided by the real Michael Malice, not by some persona that he adopts as he's writing his book. It's like the real Michael Malice would be telling me the story in this way with his funny asides. And so they're all throughout it. And this is interesting to me because I have a friend, I can't say his name, who is just delightfully funny, and you just love being around him.
So it's not Bob.
yeah, that was obvious enough, right?
No, it's not Bob.
Right. It was obvious. How could I be talking about
Bob?
Yeah, right. But when you put him in front of a camera, he freezes and is totally stilted. Well, in a way, that is like Bob, isn't it? Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. But he becomes stilted, humorless, unspontaneous. It's just, my gosh, is this the same person? So, you know, it's not a given that somebody with your vibrant personality, that would come through in a book. It's not necessary, but it does. So I'm happy to tell people it absolutely does come through. Yeah. So I was very pleased to see that. But also you let in the choice of quotations, the choice of anecdotes that you put in, you also let your subjects that you're covering, you let their personalities come through, so that I could definitely perceive Gavin McInnes's personality, who's in more than one chapter. His personality just flies off the page because of what you've chosen to quote and stuff.
Gavin is one of the few people that I will freely admit is significantly funnier than me. There's people who I think are funnier than me, but we're in the same because there's other people who are funnier than me. I just never thought about it. I didn't compare myself to them, you know. He is, because he told me one of my stories that's in the book back to me, and it was funnier than when I tell it. And I'm like, all right, if you're telling him my own story and you're improving it, you're funnier than I am.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of Gavin in there, and you know, he's a very important figure in this scene.
Let me say something about Twitter and humor, because sometimes, not as much lately because I've been a little busy, but sometimes just before bed, I will actually go, I won't just wait to see, look at my Twitter feed and see what pops up, but I'll go right to twitter.com/MichaelMalice just for the heck of it, just see what you've been up to. And I just love reading it. But with Twitter, I think you're crazy to think you're going to educate somebody through Twitter. Are you crazy? I mean, you can give people a link. Somebody,
you can educate a third party.
You can educate a third party. Yeah. And sometimes people will say, hey, Woods, what can I read about blah, blah, blah?
No, that's not what I mean. Link. Like, if I'm clowning someone, the person observing that interaction might learn something.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt about it. So Are you doing Twitter primarily to – how would you rank the following reasons you're using Twitter?
To entertain
yourself, to educate the public, or to entertain the public?
I'm not interested in educating the public at all. That's not even a number three. So it is to, first of all, to entertain myself, 100%. To build an audience. People support me on Patreon because of my Twitter. They tell me, hey, you make me laugh throughout the day. Here's $5. Thank you. I just bought myself a monster. That's appreciated. You could have bought that drink for your friend. That's an act of benevolence and kindness, and it's appreciated. And the other thing is, you know, there's this kind of trope about, you know, this old school husband and wife, and you know, the wife's having an affair and the husband looks the other way, and you sit him down and you tell him, and now he's upset because they had an agreement, right? Like, he'd pretend nothing's happening. So with me on Twitter, it's also, now you can't pretend you don't know. So when I call people out on crap, I don't mean people I'm interacting with, but, you know, people in positions of power, those who are watching it can't pretend they don't know. And that's a big one.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. All right, we're going to wrap up here. We got tomorrow. I want to talk about democracy. You have a great chapter on democracy in there, and that might lead also further into a discussion of the media, because you also deal with how some of these folks handle the media. But of course, everybody should be, in the meantime, grabbing their copy. You can easily do this over at Amazon, The New Right, A Journey to the Fringe of American Politics. Remember, Michael is the narrator of the audiobook version. You get to hear it in Michael's voice, because sometimes the narrators of these audiobooks, they think they're reading the instructions for operating a microwave oven. They're terrible.
And I do all the voices of the characters, too.
Are you kidding me?
I am not.
Oh, all right, people.
I submit that it is absolutely unconscionable. I did my rant pretty well.
All right. Well, listen, here's what I want you to do. If you go to tomwoodsaudio.com, you can get the audiobook version for free through the Audible offer there, and Michael still gets his royalty. So everybody's happy. You get a free audiobook when you join. If you don't want to stick with Audible, you can quit and keep your free audiobook. Michael still gets his royalty, and you get yourself a free audiobook. So tomwoodsaudio.com is how to get that. Link to Michael's book, The New Right, A Journey to the Fringe of American Politics, will be available at tomwoods.com/1411, our show notes page for today. We'll see you tomorrow as Michael Malice Week continues.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.